Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on poison drops in the Federal Senate when we come back. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper are things like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, our Congress said that there is no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and the value of clad coin and currency. And you know that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money. Now, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew as a matter of law that gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for you and I to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, our Congress and our politicians didn't take that gold and silver away from us for no good reason either. They knew full well back in 1933 when they did it, that in order to subjugate a free people, you first have to take away their gold and silver coin so that you can take away their right to property and to destroy those property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation to all of our liberties. So let me show you how to do just that. It's in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschool. Now, for more information about my private business school, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? You know, that's the place to start. It's a commentary on the law in general. And it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. Just call and ask for it. It's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. So if you're online, why don't you go to our website, georgegordon.org, and click on to the archives page, archives, and you can download that free general law CD package right there in the privacy of your own home. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we're talking about this thing of crime being caused by public school. That's a pretty revolutionary thought, pretty revolutionary or controversial concept, a theory. And a fellow by the name of Zach Montgomery first wrote about it in 1886. Remember, Zach was the guy that was nominated to be the Assistant Attorney General in the Cleveland administration back in 1885. He was rejected by the Senate. And the reason that he was rejected was because of his stand on public school. Now, today, if a politician were to say, "I'm opposed to public school and I think they ought to be abolished," do you think that guy could get elected? Do you think that a judge coming up for an appointment in the Senate, if he were asked, "What do you think about our public school system?" And this prospective judge said, "Yeah, I think that the public school system should be abolished and we should go back to homeschool and parochial school." Would the politician running for office get the votes of the school teachers and the school administrators and college professors and all the people that are associated with the educational system? Would the average Joe Sixpack voter out here vote for somebody like that? Just ask yourself, you know, you're a voter, you're an adult. Would you vote for somebody that said, I think that the public school system should be abolished? Irrespective of what your religious or your political views may be, it's a pretty revolutionary concept. Public education is the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto, in case you didn't know that. Now you do. It calls for free education for all children in public school. That was Karl Marx back in 1848. Now, he didn't think that up all by himself. That principle of educational philosophy has been around since the Babylonian mystery religion back in Babylon, you know, some, 2300 B.C. Been around forever. Probably came through the flood with Noah and one of his boys. Well, now, we're up to the point where we're trying to show, now I showed you in the last program that insanity and suicide among people who attend public school is twice as high as it is among people who do not. Now, that was true between 1850 and 1880. It's true today. True today. And violence that we see at Columbine High School and all these public school shootings, you don't see that going on over here at the local Catholic high school. But we see it in the public high school. Why is that? What is it about this public education that is so radically different from parochial and homeschool education that it promotes these school shootings? It promotes that kind of violence. Well, taking a look at crime here, Zach Montgomery, remember in the last program, asked the question, as we were talking about compulsory education, would you want to entrust your daughter and her education to you in combination with two of your best friends, two of your best church buddies that have this, share the same religion that you do, probably go hunting with you, and maybe even vote with you, belong to the same political party? And we took a look at that, and you know, your common sense would say, no, I don't think I would entrust the education of my child even to my two best friends. But we've already done that in entrusting the education and the curriculum of our children to millions of people out there that vote every election, vote in the school board, vote in the politicians that make the laws and the policies that we follow in our public schools. People that belong to the other political party, belong to other religious groups and organizations, and they are influencing, they are educating your child. Now, if you're opposed to that, and you're saying, well, I don't like that idea, you can opt out of that anytime you want. At least here in the United States, I can't speak for you people in France and Germany now, Myanmar, China, or someplace else. You know, you may have a different problem, but at least here in the United States, and I suspect in Canada and Australia, and probably most of the countries of Western Europe, where Anglo-Saxon administration has prevailed in the past and probably still prevails to some degree today, you can educate your child at home or you can educate them in parochial school. You can break this cycle. But the first thing we need to do is to find out, well, what is the problem, and then what are some logical proposed solutions to it? Well, listen to this. As to the cause of crime in public school, how is it that our educated boys find their way into the penitentiary? Now, here we will suppose is an honest, industrious, hard-working, laboring man who has a family consisting of himself, his wife, and half dozen children, half boys and half girls. To put the case in as favorable an aspect as possible, we will suppose that he is in moderately good circumstances, being out of debt, and the owner of a comfortable homestead. But he is compelled to rely solely on his own labor and that of his wife for means wherewith to feed and clothe his family. Now all of his children are of an age to attend school, and all of them are attending the public schools as the law directs. In the first place, heavy and frequent drafts are made on the father's scanty and hard-earned resources in order to supply these six children with all of the required books and stationery. Now, think about that. Public school may be free, but every year you're forced to buy clothes. These are your school clothes. And you have to buy books and notebooks and pencils and one thing and another that the schools do not provide. Well, these six children, too, must each and all be dressed, not according to the means of their parents, but according to the rules of the school and the demands of fashion. And inasmuch as the more wealthy and aristocratic classes prescribe the law of fashion, they must dress as well as the children of the man who counts his wealth by the millions. Now, if you do not so dress, they will have to encounter not only the contemptuous sneers of fellow students and classmates, but perhaps the displeasure of teachers, if not expulsion from school. Now, the father would reason and perhaps remonstrate with the teacher on the subject of these rigid and extravagant rules of dress, but then he remembers that the law has said that the teacher of a public school is not the agent of the parent, and is not answerable to the parent for his conduct toward the pupil. He also remembers that the law makes it criminal for a parent to insult a teacher, while the teacher may insult the parent with impunity. And for these reasons, he does not care to risk an altercation with the teacher on the subject of the boy's dress. It would be too unequal a contest. So in order to meet these growing demands for books, stationery, and clothing for their children, these poor parents are compelled to work harder, dress lighter, and feed more scantily than is compatible with either their health or their comfort. Now, the father rises early in the morning, or earlier in the morning than formerly. He works later at night and goes with worn-out, ragged, or patched-up clothes in order that his eldest boy may get a new suit so as to make as respectable an appearance as any lad at the Lincoln School. The mother, too, in worn-out and tattered apparel, plies her washboard with unwonted vigor in order to get money to pay the dressmaker for fitting, cutting, and making Lizzie's nice new dress, for the teacher says she must not come to school looking like an old washerwoman's girl. The daughter, too, is learning to play upon the piano, and of course it will not do for her to lend a helping hand towards washing either clothes or dishes, for the teacher says that it will spoil the shape of her fingers and impair the delicacy of her sense of touch. Thus both the father and mother work harder than slaves and dress coarser than beggars in order that their children may enjoy the great advantages of our glorious free school system of education. Now in the meantime, these children are sitting in the same classes, studying the same books, wearing the same costly fabrics, participating in the same amusements, contracting the same habits, imbibing in the same love of ease and the same aversion to manual labor, and the same contempt for manual labor and manual laborers as do their far more wealthy and aristocratic fellow students. Now, leaving out of sight the five younger children, we shall now give our undivided attention to the eldest son of this poor laborer. After years of study, the young man at length completes his course at the Lincoln High School, acquitting himself with great honor, amidst the cordial congratulations of professors and school directors, and eliciting the vociferous applause of the admiring multitude. This, after all, is graduation. We may imagine we see his poor old father crouching on the outskirts of the crowd, feasting his eyes upon an occasional glimpse of his son, but not daring to approach his son because he has no clothes fit to be seen on such an occasion. Doubtless that father is picturing to himself a brilliant future for his son. He is perhaps looking forward to the time when his son shall be a governor, or a senator, or possibly even president of the United States. Very likely, too, he fancies that in his declining years he shall be able to look to his son for that assistance and support, which his own exhausted means may then refuse to afford him. But alas, how baseless are all of these castles in the air! The day after graduating from school, the young man finds himself, for once, thrown now upon his own unaided resources. His father says to him, "Well, my boy, I have been a long time struggling with poverty and want in order that you might become educated. You see that both your mother and I are in rags, and that handsome suit which you now wear is yet to be paid for. You now have a fortune in your education, and hereafter you must learn to shift for yourself, and if possible, lend a helping hand from time to time to the support of your younger brothers and sisters." Thus situated, the young man probably, for the first time in his whole life, asks himself seriously this question: what business he is going to follow? Now, a more appropriate question might be, what business can he follow? Now, there he stands in the midst of a great bustling city, without a cent of money at his command, without friends, without occupation, and without the necessary qualifications for any earthly employment within his reach. Probably his first effort will be to find a position as clerk in some bank or other business establishment. But he soon learns that all of these positions are all filled by the sons of wealthy and or other influential parents in the community. Occasionally, he meets a former schoolmate discharging the duties of some coveted place, but on inquiry, he learns that he has obtained his position at the instance of a wealthy father or an influential friend. Failing in everything else, the young man at length seeks for copying as a means of earning bread. He gets hold of a city directory and makes a list of the names and locations of all the law offices in the city. He then goes from office to office in quest of the only work he really knows how to do. But everywhere he is forestalled. Everywhere he is doomed to disappointment. On every hand he meets young men and boys that are similarly situated and making themselves fruitless efforts to raise a few dimes with which to stave off starvation. Already the boy has spent weeks in an earnest but vain endeavor to find work as a copyist. In the meantime, he has been living partly on his old father and partly on what he could pick up at the free lunch tables. Seeing the son's extreme embarrassment, the father perhaps suggests to him that, inasmuch as he has been disappointed in everything else, he had better come and help him lay down some cobblestones on Battery Street, where he can at least earn enough money to buy victuals and clothes. But alas, the lad's hands are totally unused to toil, and what is infinitely worse, he has been, as we before said, so trained up as to despise both manual labor and manual laborers. He would be ashamed for one of his school companions to even meet him walking the street in company with his own father, because of the old man's horn-like palms and his laborer's dress. So that even if he knew how to work, still in view of the fact that it was only the other day that he finished his educational course with so much amidst the shower of bouquets as rained down upon him from the fair hands of San Francisco's wealth and beauty, is it to be expected that he is now going to have cobblestones on the public streets under the very shadow of his alma mater, the Lincoln High School, to be twitted and jeered at by those who envied him and the literary honors with which he came loaded from the Lincoln School? No, no, that is totally impossible. Propose anything but that. Yet, says the young man, something must be done, and something must be done soon. I must have clothes, and I must have bread. The world owes me a living, and I intend to have it. Thus saying, he turns his back upon his humble and destitute home and betakes himself again to the streets, ready for any desperate turn in events that promises him money. Stop here and make a comment or two. Does this sound like America today? You know, you got all these young people that have put themselves into debt and to put themselves through college. And now they've got a degree from college and they're going into the worst employment market in the history of the nation. 9 million unemployed. And now they're coming out of colleges, you know, with their degrees, educated. Now, would any of these people coming out of college go into the lettuce fields of California and compete for jobs against the Mexicans working there? Would any of these people want to go out and pick strawberries in Florida, oranges in Texas? Oh, no, no. Let's wake up and smell the coffee. These people, when they go to college and they come out of the educational institutions, they have a distaste for labor, and they have a particular distaste for laborers. That's below my dignity. Although, we find that college professors are sometimes underemployed and required to drive taxi cabs in New York. Now, we might take a job driving a truck or driving a cab or doing something where we don't have to work. But can you imagine getting your hands dirty trying to change a battery in a car? Or get a job repairing automobiles, you know, in a garage. And your problem is that you're not trained. You know, if you came out of college and you're trained as a, you know, let's say as a geologist or a biologist or maybe an engineer or something, you know. And so all of a sudden, now you can't find a job. There's nothing cooking, you know, in your profession. So you don't have any money with which to open your own business. And could you now take a job as Mr. Goodwrench? How's that going to work out? Well, that's where this young man finds himself back at the turn of the century. So let the reader pause here and ask himself this question. What is there to save this youth from becoming a pest to society, a disgrace to his old father and mother, and finally a convicted felon, doomed to serve the state within penitentiary walls? Perhaps it will be claimed that the bare recollection of his newly acquired literary honors and the fear of losing the esteem of those who, the other day, so vociferously applauded his youthful oratory and threw at his feet such a profusion of flowers ought of itself to be sufficient to shield him from temptation's harm. But unfortunately, those withered flowers will not serve for food, nor can he make clothes either of approving smiles or shouts of applause. But can it be possible, you say, that one so young, so intelligent, and so well educated has no respect for the law? Why, sir, if you talk to him about respecting the law, he will laugh you to scorn. Who is it that respects the law, he will say, except just so far as the law subserves his purposes? Have we not laws against bribery? And yet do not even our lawmakers on election day send out their dirty minions with money in their pockets with which to buy their way into the very halls of legislation? Are not the seats in the United States Senate sometimes bought with gold? And does not even the election of a United States president often depend more upon successful lying, frauds, and bribery than upon the people's honest votes? Then why prat you to me about the sanctity of the law when the very men who make these laws trample them unceremoniously under their feet whenever it suits their purpose? But, you will say, if this youth has no regard for human law, surely he cannot be wholly indifferent to the laws of God. Well, be not so fast, my dear sir. Have you forgotten that the boy was educated in our public schools, where it is a criminal offense punishable by a forfeiture of all interest in the public school monies to even mention the subject of religion in the hearing of a pupil, where prayer is abolished and the Bible is banned? And do you know that there is no such prohibition against inculcating the horrible doctrines of atheism in these very same schools, or witchcraft? Now, that many of our public school teachers are avowed atheists who believe neither in God nor the devil, neither in hell nor in heaven, and that our young hero is a firm believer in these dismal and diabolical doctrines. Very true, you say. I knew very well that no religion was allowed to be taught in the public schools, but then why did not his father and mother teach him religion at home? Well, we first answer the question by asking another, and it is this. How do you know that his parents themselves had any well-defined notions of religion, or in fact any religion at all? If they had firmly believed in the teachings, even of that natural religion which an almighty hand has written in indelible characters on every human heart, they surely would never have consented to surrender to the public at large the right to select the teachers, and in all essential particulars to shape the mental and moral as well as the physical destinies of their own child, would they? Now, I guess we should ask ourselves that very question right here. If you're educating your children in public school, as my parents sent me off to public school, we had no defined system of religion or morality in our home. After all, my father was educated in public school. His father was educated in public school, and as far as I know, my great-grandfather was educated in public school. I mean, it went back several generations, and we didn't have any particular religious ideology to fall back on to start with. And even if you have, can the parents at home overcome the peer pressure of the other students and the school? I mean, I went to public school and they taught us evolutionary philosophy there. And then I can remember asking questions about evolution in the public school, and Adam and Eve in the garden, and the teacher, the one I'm thinking about here, my ag teacher, kind of snickered a little bit, and he said, son, as you progress along, and these fairy tales from the Bible become clearer and clearer to you that they're in reality fairy tales, like Santa Claus and Easter bunnies, then you can better understand the hard science of actually experimenting. And that's what life is all about. It's about science, not about fairy tales. Think about that. Now suppose that his parents were in every other particular real models of perfection, both in their professions and in their practices of religion. Was it to be expected that he, their son, would accept religious instruction from his parents? Are not his parents illiterate? And is not he educated? And shall wisdom take lessons from ignorance? Has he not learned to despise them both for their poverty and their simplicity? Can it be doubted that even the sacrifices which they made in his behalf, that the very patches with which they mended their old garments in order that he might be handsomely dressed, that the very toils and hardships which have wrinkled their brows, soiled their features, and imparted the bony touch of their palms, in order that he might learn to lead a life of ease and freedom from manual labor, are, on his part, required and requited with coldness and contempt? And after learning to despise his parents, is it at all likely that he would profit either by their religious instruction or their praiseworthy example? No, no, sir. Their religion, just like their toilsome lives and their old clothes, may be good enough for them. But to an educated young man like himself, it is only a bundle of cumbersome and useless rubbish, and he will have none of it. Well, then, since our young hero has learned to respect neither the laws of man nor the laws of God, and will neither be directed by the good counsels nor influenced by the exemplary lives of his own father and mother, where, let it then be asked, shall we look for the controlling power that is to shape his future destiny? Well, just follow him as he hurries along yonder busy street, and you'll see. Already he is in company with a half a dozen of his late schoolmates, each of whom has a tale of woe and disappointments to tell, quite like his own. Now, for the first time since leaving school, each and all of these boys find themselves in congenial society. They feel that the world cares nothing for them, and they care nothing for the world. They all have empty stomachs and seedy clothes, and there is not enough money in the crowd to purchase even one night's lodging at the meanest lodging house in the city. So one of the party suggests that, having failed in everything else, he has an idea of making an effort to get a position as dishwasher in some hotel, or failing in that also, he might seek employment as a stable boy to clean out the stalls of some livery stable. The majority of his companions, however, frown upon this kind of proposition with contemptuous indignation, and our hero threatens never hereafter to speak to the low-bred rascal, should he ever again be guilty of advancing such a proposition so far beneath the dignity of an educated gentleman. In order, however, to put at rest the question as to the feasibility of finding even that kind of employment, one little fellow, the smallest in the crowd, puts in a word to assure his companions that there is not enough in the last suggestion to be worth quarreling about. He says, and he has been, for the past 3 days and a good part of the night, hunting from house to house, both in public hotels and private dwellings, for any kind of light work such as boys could do. And everywhere he's found the field already occupied, most always by Chinamen. Whereupon they all agree that they could not if they would, and would not if they could, enter into successful competition with the Chinamen for the honor of discharging the menial duties of either stable boys or kitchen servants. Well, boys and girls, isn't that where our society is today? Do you think you'll find an American out here competing with the local Mexican to drag brush or to pick strawberries or lettuce? Well, at this particular juncture, one of the party suggests that his old widowed aunt has $500 in gold 20s buried under her barn floor, and that he knows just where to find the cash. They can get this money, and nobody but themselves need to be any the wiser for it. He says she has plenty without that, and she is such a stingy old hag that it would be serving her just right for them to go and relieve her of that $500. We do not propose to follow this little band of young hoodlums further for the present, but if any friend of our present public school system can discover any motive which will deter from crime and preserve from the penitentiary any one of the hundreds upon hundreds of our city's youths whose education and situation in life differ in no essential particular from that of the boys just above described, he will, by pointing out such a motive, unquestionably confer a great and lasting benefit both on the rising generation and on society at large. From the fate of this eldest boy of our poor laborer, we shall leave the reader to guess the doom which awaits this young man and his younger brothers and sisters. Now, while it's perfectly true that not everybody who attends public school goes and robs his aunt of her $500 under the barn floor with drugs on the market, it's very common for young people to rob their aunts and uncles and their parents and others to obtain the money to buy the drugs, much less to buy the necessities of life. I mean, that's as common as pig tracks in a barnyard, isn't it? Hey, I'm at the halfway point here, so let me give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. This book is called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. It is written by Zach Montgomery. You can probably get a copy by going to the bravenewbookstore.com. I think that's where I would start my quest. Now, I picked this up somewhere at a Patriot meeting where they have books for sale on the back counter, you know. This is many years ago, and I picked up the book and I saw it, and I said, Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, and I said, I wonder what that's about, and I bought 7 or 8 books, like I typically do. And then I noticed that it was published by the St. Thomas Press. Now, I don't know if they're still in operation or not. I've seen that name before on old, out-of-date books, books that have long since, you know, been forgotten. St. Thomas Press. They're at Post Office Box 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235. They may still be there, and you may be able to get a copy of it. St. Thomas Press now, P.O. Box 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235. Now, if you're lazy like I am, and you don't want to write letters, I mean, you might get online and find St. Thomas Press. I think that's probably the place to start. But there's a place that almost works without fail, and it's called the Brave New Bookstore. They're down in Austin, Texas. BraveNewBookstore.com. They specialize in books like this. And this is their forte. They're not selling Lady Chatterley's Lover, and they're not selling Harlequin. They're selling political, economic, educational material. These are dedicated people. They're dedicated to saving the nation, saving the republic, educating people to the perversity that's going on around us. And they do a hell of a job. Now, it's called Brave New Bookstore. They've got a telephone number. It's 512-480-2503. That number, again, is 512-480-2503. Now, when you have a book like this that's out of print, or, you know, published, you know, 150 years ago, and it's probably not in print, you'll be amazed at how many times these old books have been reprinted. And these people specialize in finding those sources. And they've got contacts with wholesalers and jobbers. So if the book is being printed by anybody, like St. Thomas Press or somebody else, they'll order a case of them and bring them into their store, and then they'll start promoting those. So yeah, that being the case, that's the place where I would start. Brave New Bookstore is on the web, bravenewbookstore.com. Again, that's bravenewbookstore.com. They're located at 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, Austin, Texas. In case you want to write to them, I can't imagine why, but you might. That's 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, Austin, Texas. The zip code is 78705. 78705. And let's take a look here in retrospect and think about this for a minute. Now, I said the other day that professional people are parasites, and that offends people, and I don't deny it. So let me back that up, and I'll tell you why. A young man starts school. He's 6 years old, and his parents send him off to public school, let's say, in Brooklyn, New York, you know, to PS 235. And he starts his career there, and as time progresses along, he receives a liberal arts education through grammar school, middle school, and high school. When he completes high school, which is pretty much mandatory, I mean, he doesn't have to graduate, but, you know, it's pretty well mandatory that he'd be there till he's 16. He's encouraged by his teachers, and probably by his parents, to get a college education. Now, he doesn't have any money. You know, he probably isn't coming from a wealthy family there in Brooklyn, but, you know, he's inspired, and somebody says, well, now, you can get a college education if you join the Army. Join the Army. So he does. He joins the military as soon as he graduates from high school, spends a few years in the military services, and he gets his GI benefits, and he goes on to college. Who pays for that college education? Well, you and I do. You and I, the taxpayers, paid for his education. Then you and I, the taxpayers, paid to support this young man while he was in the military. So far, up through his graduation from college, at, say, age 30. Remember, he served 4 years or 6 years or 8 years maybe, like my son did. He served two hitches in the Army. And then came out of the Army and go on to some kind of school. Now, for the first 30 years of this young man's life, he has produced absolutely nothing, zero. He is a total non-producer. And during that 30 years of life, while he's been going to grammar school, middle school, high school, Army, military services, and so on, and college, he has been sucking off the public, you and me. You and I have been building buildings and plumbing and paving parking lots and so on. We've been out working and producing, paying our taxes, and supporting this young man. Now he has a profession. Now this young man graduates, and he's now a dentist, a doctor, a lawyer. He's somebody with a profession. He goes out and he opens a store on borrowed money. And he starts fixing our teeth or doctoring us or, you know, engineering, doing whatever he's doing. And then he starts paying taxes. And now he's called a productive member of society because he's paying taxes. But what is the young man doing, or the young woman in this case, maybe, what is this young person doing over here to produce wheat, corn, beans, honey, oil, housing, clothing, the things that we all consume? And you say, well, he's fixing our teeth. Well, if we were practicing those 19 health laws of the Bible, we wouldn't have rotten teeth, and if we didn't have rotten teeth, there wouldn't be any need for dentists, and the poor guy'd be unemployed, wouldn't he? So he depends then upon the perversity and the criminal behavior of the populace at large in order for him to ply his profession. Same thing with doctors. Same thing with lawyers. You know, if you had a legal education from the Bible, what would you need a lawyer for? If you knew what the laws were, wouldn't you obey the laws? And if everybody obeyed the laws, well, then they wouldn't need a lawyer, would they? All of the professions are services that are provided under license. And a license is, by definition, permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. Look it up. It's in Bouvier's Law Dictionary. A license is permission to do something that's illegal. So if you have a license, whatever it is that you have your license for is an illegal practice. It violates the law somewhere. That's why you have to have the license. And in almost every case, it violates some law, rule, custom, usage, or practice of the scripture. It violates the law of God is what it does. So the state comes along and licenses that activity. Take a medical doctor, for instance. See, we have a law in the scripture that says you shall do no murder. And in Exodus 15:26, God says, I am your healer. And so the medical profession comes along and says, no, you evolved from green algae. There is no God. And furthermore, we're going to take over and usurp this particular occupation over here, or profession, so that we can make profit and gain from it. We want to make money from it. And they do. And they don't make any bones about it. And so the doctor goes out here, and now he starts off, he calls himself a healer, and so he's out here healing people. In violation of what? Well, in violation of the statute or the provision in Exodus 15:26, for which he needs a license, because once in a while he kills people. Yeah, that's right. In fact, doctors here in the United States cause what's called iatrogenic disease, doctor-induced disease. They kill about 130,000 people a year in this country. They kill people around the world, you know, doing the same thing, but in this country, it's about 130,000 a year. Now, as a result of that, because of that, they have to be licensed by the state to give them an exception, an exoneration for the mistakes that they make. They say, you know, in this country, they say doctors bury their mistakes. So it violates the scripture, and so they're licensed, and they become very successful. They make a lot of money. But let's, for the sake of our discussion here, let's follow the advice of our school teachers and our parents, and let's everybody in the country become a professional. Let's send everybody in the country to college. Let's just do this for about 40 or 50 years until everybody in the country now has one of the 15 professions. He's either a doctor, a lawyer, a dentist, an engineer, he's something. And now we put all of these people out here into the marketplace. What kind of a society would you have? Everybody would be a school teacher, a lawyer, and a doctor. You wouldn't have any building crafts. You won't find anybody engaged in driving taxi cabs, picking lettuce, milking cows, tramping silage, plumbing houses, building high-rise buildings. These people, now, there are professionals that work in the building trades. I don't deny it. But they're not the people that are laying brick or carrying hod or finishing cement. You don't find any professionals out there doing that. Who's going to pick your lettuce? Who's going to bus your tables? Who's going to wait on tables? Who's going to cook? You see, all of those jobs, all of that employment that goes on behind the scenes that makes life what it is, wherever you live, whatever you do, is done by people who do the labor, the manual, menial tasks. They're the people who make your bed at the Holiday Inn and clean your room. Now, those are the producers. Those are the people that do the services and make the goods, that build the automobiles and the Winnebagos for you to drive. And those are the people that are out there actually doing the work. there won't be any of those people. There wouldn't be a single one of them. Now, what kind of a society are you going to have? Because this is what they're advertising for, and so far, they've done a hell of a job. We've gotten to the point now in America where we have to import multiple millions of aliens to do that kind of work. Which to them, you know, is like heaven. You take a man from Mexico where unemployment is around 20% and bring him to the United States where he can make minimum wage, even less than that. Just pay the guy $5 an hour, less than minimum wage. Slave labor, we call that. Those people as an aggregate group send $17 billion a year back to Mexico. It's the biggest single source of revenue in that country, next to petroleum. Petroleum's number one, and foreign money coming back into the country from the United States is number two at $17 billion a year. Those people thrive here. People from all around the world can come to the United States, Canada, Australia, or Western Europe, for that matter. They try to sneak across, you know, from Algeria to France or Italy. I mean, those people are sneaking into Europe, you know, just like they're sneaking into the United States. And that's because living conditions are so poor where they're from. Average wage in Mexico, if you're employed, is $9 a day. Hell, if that guy can get into the States and work for $5 an hour, for crying out loud, he'll make five times more than if he were gainfully employed in Mexico. An illegal alien in the United States working for below minimum wage makes five times more than an average employed person in Mexico, for crying out loud. No, those people aren't doing bad at all. They're doing wonderfully well here in this country. And that's why they want to come here. It's not because Americans never could work. There was a time in this country when Americans could pick lettuce, and we did. There was a time in this country when Americans could do all of the work that is done in this country. But we weren't trying to send everybody to college. Henry Ford didn't go to college, and neither did Thomas Edison. They became, over time, very successful people in the country, but Ford only went to the sixth grade, I think it was, and Thomas Edison only to the third. They could both read and write, but they didn't have some advanced degree. Now, here's my point. It isn't necessary to go to college to be successful. In fact, Bill Gates didn't go to college, and he's no slouch now, is he? I think he's the world's richest man. Now, that's not to say that going to college is all bad. I'm not opposed to you going to college. That's a choice that people have to make. What I'm opposed to is taking taxpayer funds to loan you money to send you off to college so that you can default on your college loan and not pay it back. I'm opposed to that. I don't want to pay for that. I don't want to pay for anchor babies in the hospitals, and I don't want to pay for AIDS patients who have a bad lifestyle and get AIDS. They got a group here in this country, it's called ACT UP, and they're always out here causing some kind of civil disobedience for the express purpose of drawing attention to themselves so that the Congress will enact legislation to produce more research money to find a cure for AIDS. We have a cure for AIDS. Don't practice sodomy. And if you want to practice sodomy, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success, but just don't ask me to pay for it and underwrite it and subsidize it. That's all. I mean, I'm not opposed to people that want to ride the roller coaster. I just don't want to buy your ticket. I'm not opposed to somebody building something like a roller coaster or a theme park like Disneyland or something like that, but don't ask me to pay for your trip there, or to pay for the tickets for your pleasures. I think Carnival cruises are great, but don't ask me to buy your ticket. Those are choices that every individual needs to make for himself. Now, I chose not to go to college, and I'm not dissatisfied with my outcome. I've lived a happy, successful life, and I've had a great time the whole time I've been here. I could die in the morning, and I'd never have any regrets. And I hope to live to be another 10 or 20 years older than I am today. And I'm not asking anybody out there to feed, clothe, or house me. I'm an old man, and I'm not on Social Security. And, you know, I'm not unique. There are other people out there that have withdrawn their hand from Social Security and the social safety net that's offered by government to create a nation of dependents. And that's what the professions are. The professions are a system of dependency. You can't practice your profession without a license. You've got to have the government's permission to set up a monopoly on that street corner, and you have to pay your taxes, and you have to support this godless system, whether you like it or not. Now, you know, it may well be that that's what you want to do. Well, then, you shouldn't have any complaints. I have professional people that come to school here complaining about the taxes that they're required to bear. And so I start off by explaining to them that you have a very coveted and a very good position in society. You are a taskmaster. And if you remember the movie The Ten Commandments, Edward G. Robinson was an Israelite, and he was a taskmaster working for the oppressors, the Egyptians. And his job was to keep the Israelites working. He had a very important job. He didn't work himself, which is why he wanted to be a taskmaster. Hey, listen, professionals don't work themselves, which is why they want to be professionals. It's so that they can serve and service the needs of the people out there who are themselves being required to work and pay the taxes to support the people who don't have to work. So the benefit that you get is you make a lot of money, and then you don't have to work if you're successful in your profession. Now, the problem that you've got here is that you've reached the tipping point. You've got so many people now coming out of college that these people don't have positions out here in the society. You got too many dentists, too many doctors. You know, you got too many people coming out, too many teachers and so on, people that aren't needed. And yet you're encouraged to go to college so that you can get this great education. Well, the machine has been built. The machine is the college educational industry, like the military-industrial complex. And as a result of that, these people have to continually promote going to college. And so they promote it, and more people go to college, and more people get degrees, and then they get out there into the world where they're not needed. And so now you've run up this humongous debt. This is your college tuition loan fund. and then when you actually get out there into the workplace, you find out that, hey, there's no work out there for me. That's precisely what Zach Montgomery pointed out here. The young man graduates from high school. It used to be if you had a high school education, you know, you were pretty well educated. And then it got to the point, well, high school wouldn't do it, so now you got to have some specialty. I had a brother-in-law, nice guy, and he just like the man I told you about here, a little kid in Brooklyn, he went to work and spent his entire life in the military, and now he's out of the military, drawing his pension. He has never produced anything realistic for the benefit of mankind in his entire lifetime. Not one thing. A total parasite for his entire life. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.